Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today's the 5th of June. We will continue listening to Tendon's previous program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Race of Sin by Lam Kapow. And enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome. For a bit of a joke, let's start off today with a Mulla Nasruddin story. Do you know Mulla Nasruddin? He's a kind of folklore character built on a real-life personality, Mulla Nasruddin Khodja, described in the website www.muslimheritage.com as a wise man famous throughout the Muslim and some parts of the non-Muslim world since the 16th century. Historical documents show that he lived in the 13th century in Anatolia, today Turkey. He was a scholar, or at least an educated man. His jokes were narrated for centuries between people for different purposes, some for humor, and some to tell his stories full of meaning and wisdom. Further on, the website says, according to different sources, Nasruddin Khodja was a philosopher, wise, witty man with a good sense of humor. His stories have been told almost everywhere in the world, spread amongst the tribes of the Turkish world and into Persia, Arabia, Africa, and along the Silk Road to China and India, later also to Europe. Of course, all these stories, currently attributed to the Khodja for about 700 years, haven't originated from him. Most of them are the product of collective humor of not only Turks, but also other people of Islamic and Asian cultures. So, with Mulla Nasruddin's stories, you will often laugh as you're given a bit of a moral lesson or uplifting. The story that opens the program is titled Mulla Nasruddin Feeds His Coat and is taken from www.uua.org. Mulla Nasruddin had been working in the fields all day long. The story opens and then continues. He was tired and sweaty and his clothes and shoes were covered with mud and stains. Because he'd been fasting all day long for Ramadan, he was also quite hungry. But finally, it was almost sundown, and Nasruddin knew that he would soon be able to eat. The wealthiest man in town had invited everyone to come break their fast in his home that evening with a huge feast. Nasruddin knew that he would be late if he went home to change his clothes before heading into town. He decided it was better to arrive in dirty clothes than to be late. Oh, what a party it would be! What a feast! As he walked to the wealthy man's home, Nasruddin imagined the delicious foods that he would soon be eating. Dates, lentils and chickpeas, olives and bread, hummus, falafel, chicken and beef, and best of all the desserts, halva, date rolls, figs and baklava. When Nasruddin arrived, the wealthy man opened the door and looked Nasruddin up and down scornfully, from his worn, ragged clothes down to his muddy shoes. Without a word of welcome, he gestured for Nasruddin to come in and walked abruptly away. Nasruddin joined the throngs of people who were all dressed in their finest clothing. The tables were laden with all sorts of delicious foods, dates, lentils and chickpeas, olives and bread, hummus, falafel, chicken, beef, and best of all the desserts, halva, date rolls, figs, and baklava. Despite his efforts to hurry, the seats were all taken, and nobody tried to move over or make a space for Nasruddin. In fact, nobody offered him food. He had to reach over and around people to get any food for his plate. Nobody spoke to him. It was as if he wasn't even there. The other guests ignored him so completely that Nasruddin could not enjoy the food on his plate. no matter how finely prepared and how tasty it was. In fact, after only a few bites, Nasruddin was so uncomfortable that he decided to leave. He hurried home and changed into his finest clothing, including a beautiful coat. Nasruddin returned to the feast, and this time the host welcomed him with a huge smile. Come in," greeted the host. As Nasruddin entered, people waved and called to him from all corners of the room as they invited him to sit near them and offered him food. Nasruddin sat down quietly. Picking up a plump fig, he carefully placed it into a coat pocket, saying, "Eat, coat, eat." Next, he took a handful of nuts and put them into the pocket, saying, "Eat, coat, eat." And now he began to feed his coat in earnest, grabbing all sorts of food. He fed the coat lentils and chickpeas, olives and bread, hummus, falafel, chicken and beef, and best of all the desserts, halva, date rolls, figs, and baklava. Nasruddin became silent as they watched this strange behavior. Soon everyone in the room was staring at Nasruddin, wondering what he was doing. The host hurried over. "Whatever are you doing? Why are you feeding your coat in this manner?" "Well," replied Nasruddin, "when I first came to this feast in my old farming clothes, I was not welcome. No one would speak to me. But when I changed into this coat, suddenly I was greeted warmly. So I realized it was not me that was welcome at this party, but my clothing. And so I'm feeding my coat." Now you might think this is a rather silly story, but it says something about what we are talking about in our last program. If you were with us, you might remember that we were exploring commentaries on the maxim, "Don't malign others," from Namkar Pal's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. And we'd come to the point of discussing how often we rely on first impressions of others to make our judgments about them, but usually these first impressions are inaccurate and misleading. If, not attempting to get to know them better, we then criticize or malign someone on the basis of that first impression, we can commit grave mistakes that will lead to a lot of suffering and embarrassment, both for ourselves and those we are bad-mouthing. Does it matter that the shoddily dressed Mullah Nasruddin was maligned by action rather than speech in our story? I don't think so, but he surely showed up the ridiculous shallowness and cruelty of the host and other guests. And if we judge on first impressions and outward appearances, we should expect to be shown up in the same way and be embarrassed in the same way when some smart Mullah Nasruddin type turns up to hold a mirror up to show us and all around us what we really look like. But now, before we continue, let's examine our motivation for participating in the program today, and if it's not bodhicitta, then let's make a change so that it is. Remember, bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings is the best motivation, as its object, all beings, is so vast. So let's take a moment to look at our motivation. Thank you. Now, last time we finished the program going through an article on www.theatlantic.com titled "Mixed Signals: Why People Misunderstand Each Other," and written by Emily Esfani Smith, who quotes Heidi Grant Alverson's book, "No One Understands You and What to Do About It." Alverson says that most of the time people don't realize they're not coming across the way they think they are, because we suffer from what psychologists call the transparency illusion. That is, we think what we feel, desire, and intend is crystal clear to others, even if we have not communicated it at all. Also, we and the person we are communicating with are under the control of two other psychological forces that Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, labels System 1 and System 2. We are usually cognitive misers. That is, we use shortcuts like facial expressions, body language and intentions, and the primacy effect to judge others. The primacy effect basically says that what we think and feel about a person is strongly influenced by our very first impressions of that person. First impressions are more important than later impressions and tend to color or bias later judgments. All this is analogous to Kahneman's System 1 which processes information quickly, intuitively, and automatically. Kahneman's system too, and I quote Smith, processes information in a conscious, rational, and deliberative manner. And where system one is automatic and easy, system two needs effort and diligence. So you can imagine which one most people rely on, and that is why our judgments of people are often so wrong. Now, you may remember, if you were with us, the article talks about research on this by Dan Gilbert and others of Harvard University, who conducted an experiment in which participators watched video clips of a man and woman talking. In 5 clips, the woman appeared to be stressed out and anxious. The video was silent, but subtitles showed the topics they were talking about. One group of participants were told that the two people were talking about neutral topics, while another group was told that in the 5 clips they were talking about touchy subjects like sexual fantasies, personal secrets, and life failures. Some of the participants had to memorize the discussion topics in the subtitles. In other words, they were kept mentally busy so that they had little chance of engaging Kahneman's system 2 kind of mentalization. At the end of the experiment, the participants were asked whether or not the woman was an anxious person. Those not distracted by the memorization task said, as expected, that they thought she was anxious when discussing neutral topics and acting stressed out, and not anxious when she was discussing stressful topics and acting stressed out. In other words, they were able to enter system 2 by taking the woman's situation into account. Anyone asked about her sexual fantasies would likely feel uncomfortable. Those who were kept mentally busy came to a very different conclusion. Regardless of the situation, they thought she was an anxious person. For these people, acting anxious equaled being anxious. So this is often how we operate. We make judgments about others based on our first impressions, with little intention of postponing such impressions to look deeper with system 2 type thinking. No wonder we get things regarding others wrong so much of the time. And that is where we arrived at the end of last week's program. But Emily Esteban Smith's article continues. So let's have a look at what more she and her colleagues have to say about it all. She says next that our perceptions are also clouded by our own experiences, emotions, and biases, which inevitably lead to misunderstandings. She writes, as Halvorsen puts it, everyone has an agenda when they interact with another person. That agenda is usually trying to determine one of 3 pieces of information about the perceived. Is this person trustworthy? Is this person useful to me? And does this person threaten my self-esteem? How a perceiver answers these questions will determine whether she judges the other person in a positive or negative way. Take self-esteem. Researchers have long found that individuals need to maintain a positive sense of themselves to function well. When someone's sense of herself is threatened, like when she interacts with someone who she thinks is better than her at a job they both share, she judges that person more harshly. One study found, for example, that attractive job applicants were judged as less qualified by members of the same sex than by members of the opposite sex. The raters who were members of the same sex, the researchers found, felt a threat to their self-esteem by the attractive job applicants, while the members of the opposite sex felt no threat to their self-esteem. Emily Esteban Smith continues, given the many obstacles to accurate perception, what do people have to do to come across the way that they intend to? One study hints at an answer. This was a study by Jackie D. Varawa and Stephanie Danielle Claude titled Perceived versus Actual Transparency of Goals in Negotiation. Smith writes, in this study, published in 1998 in Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin, research subjects came into the lab to conduct a mock negotiation with one other person. Each party chose a specific goal for the negotiation, like gaining the liking of the other person, or hold firm to my own personal opinions, which they went into the negotiation trying to achieve, but weren't necessarily trying to reveal to the other person. After the negotiation, each party was asked what the other person's goal was, which was an indication of how transparent the other person was. In the study, research subjects only guessed the goal of their partner correctly 26% of the time. Meanwhile, more than half of them thought that they were clearly relaying their goals and intentions to the other person. The lesson of this study is that people may think that they're being clear, but they're not. If you want to solve the problem of perception, Halvorsen says, it's much more practical for you to decide to be a good sender of signals than to hope that the perceiver is going to go into phase two of perception. It's not realistic to expect people to go to that effort. Can you imagine how exhausting it would be to weigh every possible motivation of another person? Plus, you can't control what's going on inside of another person's mind, but you can control how you come across. Emily Esteban Smith says, people who are easy to judge, people who send clear signals to others, as Halvorsen suggests people do, our researchers have found ultimately happier and more satisfied with their relationships, careers, and lives than those who are more difficult to read. It's easy to understand why. Feeling understood is a basic human need. When people satisfy that need, they feel more at peace with themselves and with the people around them who see them closer to how they see themselves. And that is Emily Esteban Smith. Now, this may seem to have strayed from our text and the slogan, "Don't malign others," but it indicates to me at least that the more we are able to communicate our intentions and so on to others, the easier it will be not to get into a situation where others can misinterpret and then criticize. And the more we can understand where they're coming from and forgive and relax. I mean, if we know that the person maligning us is operating from a system one mind, why would he get angry enough to badmouth them back? We know they're coming from a shallow and mistaken point of view. Surely compassion is then more in order than vengeance. If we make sure our judgments come from a system two mind or an I don't know point of view, we're far more likely to either make a more accurate assessment or to keep our mouth shut. Yes, it may take more effort to learn to take things slowly and engage in system two, but it seems to me the advantages are great and the effort is worthwhile. Now let's move back to mind training like the rays of the sun and the next slogan, which is don't wait in ambush. Namkha Pell comments, this refers to nursing a grudge against someone for some slight and retaliating when you're in a position to do so. Once you've entered into this practice of mind training, you cannot behave in such a fashion, since to do so would completely contradict the practice of taking others' troubles and suffering onto yourself. Now, in other commentaries, don't wait in ambush is the most common translation of this slogan, although in training the mind and cultivating loving-kindness, Chogyam Trungpa says the Tibetan version is literally don't ambush, which he says is to wait for somebody to fall down so you can attack. He continues, you're waiting for that person to fall into the trap or problem you want or expect. You want him to have that misfortune, and you hope that misfortune will take place in a way which will allow you to attack. If you are having a disagreement with somebody, you don't usually attack him or her right away because you don't want to be in a powerless position. Instead, you wait for him or her to fall apart and then you attack them. Sometimes you pretend to be his advisor and you attack him in that disguise, pointing out to him how wretched he is. You say, I've been waiting to tell you this. Now you're falling apart completely. I'm going to take the opportunity to tell you that you are not so good. I'm in much better shape than you are. That is a sort of opportunism, a bandit's approach. That bandit's approach is the meaning of waiting in ambush, which happens quite frequently. And that is Chogyam Trungpa. His student Pema Chodron also uses don't wait in ambush, which she describes as a naked truth slogan. She says, you've been taught that you should be a nice person. On the other hand, you don't feel so nice. Maybe you know something about your husband that he doesn't know you know. You keep it up your sleeve, waiting for just the right moment to spring it on him. One day, you're in the middle of a big argument, very heated. He has just insulted you royally. At that moment, you bring the ace down from your sleeve and really let him have it. That's called waiting in ambush. You're willing to be very patient until just the right moment comes along, and then you let someone have it. This isn't the path of the warrior, it's the path of the coward. Not only do you want to win, you aren't even willing to communicate. The aspiration to communicate with another person, to be able to listen and to speak from the heart, is what changes our old stuck patterns. Now, this commentary is from Pema Chodron's book, Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. Now, the willingness to communicate is the key here, isn't it? If we only want some kind of revenge, we don't want to communicate. We don't want to make peace between us. We are actually creating the cause for war, which we might think is good for us, but is poisonous for both ourselves and the one we wish to ambush. When I ambush you, I probably think that's the end of the matter and I've won. But it doesn't work like that, though, does it? Your resentment will only lead to you ambushing me later on, and so the hate cycle will continue. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese master, has written extensively on effective communication. In fact, one of his books is titled The Art of Communication. On www.dailyom.com, he gives the following teaching on what is poisonous and what is nourishing in communication. He writes, "How can you tell what communication is healthy and what is toxic? The energy of mindfulness is a necessary ingredient in healthy communication. Mindfulness requires letting go of judgment, returning to an awareness of the breath and body, and bringing your full attention to what is in you and around you. This helps you to notice whether the thought you just produced is healthy or unhealthy, compassionate or unkind. Conversation is a source of nourishment. We can all feel lonely and want to talk with someone. But when you have a conversation with another person, what that person says may be full of toxins, like hate, anger, and frustration. When you listen to what they say, you're consuming these toxins. You're bringing toxins into your consciousness and your body. And that's why mindfulness of speaking and mindfulness of listening are very important. Toxic conversation can be difficult to avoid, especially at work. If it's going on around you, be aware. You have to have enough mindful awareness not to absorb all these kinds of suffering. You have to protect yourself with the energies of compassion so that when you listen, instead of consuming toxins, you are actively producing more compassion in yourself. When you listen in this way, compassion protects you and the other person suffers less. You absorb the thoughts, speech, and actions you produce and those contained in the communications of those around you. That is consumption. So when you read something, when you listen to someone, you should be careful not to allow the toxins to ruin your health and bring suffering to you and to the other person or group of people. To illustrate this truth, the Buddha used the graphic image of a cow that has a skin disease. The cow is attacked by all kinds of insects and microorganisms coming from the soil, coming from the trees, coming from the water. Without a skin, a cow couldn't protect herself. Mindfulness is our skin. Without mindfulness, we may take in items we don't want to consume, items that can attack us. Even when you simply drive your car through the city, you consume. The advertisements hit your eyes, and you're forced to consume them. You hear sounds. You may even say things that are the product of too much toxic consumption. We have to protect ourselves. Mindful communication is the way. We can communicate in such a way as to solidify the peace and compassion in ourselves and bring joy to others. Many of us suffer because of difficult communication. We feel misunderstood, especially by those we love. In a relationship, we are nourishment for each other. So we have to select the kind of food that we offer the other person, the kind of food that can help our relationships thrive. Everything needs food in order to continue, including love, hate, or suffering. If suffering continues, it's because we keep feeding our suffering. Every time we speak without mindful awareness, we are feeding our suffering. With mindful awareness, we can look into the nature of our suffering and find out what kind of food we've been supplying to keep it alive. When we find out the source of nourishment for our suffering, we can cut off that supply, and our suffering will fade. Often a romantic relationship begins very beautifully, but then because we don't know how to nourish our love, it begins to die. Communication nourishes the relationship. Every thought you produce in your head, in your heart, in China they say in your belly, feeds that relationship. When you produce a thought that carries suspicion, anger, fear, irritation, that thought is not nourishing to you or to the other person. If the relationship has become difficult, it's because we've nourished our judgment and our anger, and we haven't nourished our compassion. We should refrain from saying or writing words that aren't nourishing and healing. Sometimes one cruel utterance can make a person suffer for many years, and you will suffer for many years too. In a state of anger or hate, you may say something that can be poisonous and destructive. You have to be very careful. So we have to learn to feed our relationships with healthy communication. Love, respect, and friendship all need food in order to survive. With mindfulness, we can produce thoughts, speech, and actions that can feed our relationships and help them grow. In the art of communication, the master has developed 6 mantras to help us to develop healthy communication. The Plato Project has adapted these mantras for their own well-being and give them on their website as follows. The first mantra is, I am here for you. Nothing is more precious than your presence, fresh, solid, free, and calm, and you offer it to your loved ones to increase their happiness and your own happiness. This can be used in 2 ways, as a direct communication with another person, showing your willingness to be present for that person, and second, as an internal dialogue with yourself, forcing one to be present in the moment. The second mantra is, I know you are there and I'm very happy. You're letting your loved one know that his or her presence is important to your happiness. The third mantra is, I know you suffer and that's why I'm here for you. This approach allows you to simply offer your own presence. The fourth mantra has the most relevance to our slogan. Instead of waiting in ambush, we can go to them and say, I suffer, please help. The Plato Project says that this mantra can be used when someone hurts us, such as when someone says something critical or dismissive. Rather than suffer in silence or seek revenge, the fourth mantra allows one to open up a dialogue with the other, Thich Nhat Hanh says. If we suffer and don't look deeply into our suffering and find compassion for ourselves and the other person, we may want to punish the person who hurts us because he or she has dared to make us suffer. He adds, to say, I don't suffer, I don't need your help, is not the language of true love. The next time you suffer and you believe it's the other person's fault and that she is the cause of your suffering, practice the fourth mantra. Then the last 2 mantras are, this is a happy moment, which can be used to demonstrate that you're there with someone who care about, and you are partly right, and this can be used when someone praises or criticizes you. If you praise me, I shouldn't get too puffed up, and when you criticize me, I shouldn't get lost in that and ignore the positive things. In this way, you retain your humility. So there's a wonderful teaching for when the thought of ambush, of revenge, pops up in our heads. Instead of giving into it, how about practicing the mantras of loving communication and System 2 thinking? And that is all for today. Our time is up. Thanks for joining the program, and please tune in again next time. Please also dedicate, as usual, to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.